Episode 176, Spelunking with Socrates.
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Matt Anderson.
And I am Ben DiBono. We are back.
Back, and we're about to do a little cave diving.
Yeah.
Is that a thing? Can you go cave diving?
Yeah. Like, because there's really deep caves, and so people, like, that's what spelunking is.
Literally diving into a cave.
Well, it's not, there's more to it than that, obviously. There's safety equipment and ropes and whatnot. You don't just walk up to a cave and jump. But yeah, that's a basic idea. That's what in Batman Begins, when he's hasn't told Lucius Fox that he's Batman yet, and he's going down for like the equipment for the cave. That's what he tells him he's going to be doing.
Oh, spelunking?
Spelunking.
Yeah, that's right. Well, so where does this title come from? What is happening here today, Ben? Another episode just like last week where you have taken on the full brunt of the planning and I've done nothing.
Well, we should explain that because I don't want people to think that you're dumb or lazy or anything like that, because you're not. You're busy.
I'm busy. Okay. Just in case you didn't hear the last episode.
Well, yeah, people might be listening. People go back and listen to old episodes.
Oh, yeah. So as we record this, it is a Wednesday. 1 week from Friday is my wedding day.
Yeah.
So it has been crazy busy getting ready for the wedding. So Ben and I have been preparing for being away from the podcast for all of August by pre-recording tons and tons of episodes. So
yeah. You're
still going to get two episodes every week. But yeah, I've been busy. So you've been doing a lot of planning for us.
Yeah. So I just want to make the point up front, though, that you're totally capable of doing the research on both these episodes as well, if not better than I could. It's just that you're busy. And so that's why I'm doing a little more talking and you're doing a little more responding.
I don't think I would say I could do this episode better than you because I've never read Plato.
Well, what I mean is that you're you have a master's degree. You're capable of reading difficult tasks.
Okay, sure.
Understanding them and all that.
I do remember, though, when we took classes together, gain our master's degree, that you would often I would say you were, what's the word that starts with D, that demeaning when it came to my abilities in Greek.
Oh man, well yeah, Greek was rough.
Yeah, it was rough. You were pretty good and I wasn't as good.
As good, but that's okay.
That's okay.
Not everybody can be as good.
So how's your Greek these days?
Oh, it's good.
Are you keeping up on it? You still doing your devotionals in the Greek Bible?
No. I mean, I'm a Catholic, so I don't have to read the Bible anymore.
No, that's not true.
That was a joke. But yeah, no, I don't necessarily sit down and do it every day or whatever, but when I need to read Greek, I can do it.
It comes right back to you?
Yeah.
The last time we took a class on Greek was August of 2011.
Oh, 2 years ago.
And the last time I read Greek...
was July 2011?
Was, August 2011.
Yeah, so it's been a while.
All right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to hit the main topic music, and then you tell us everything we're going to learn tonight.
Okay. So the title is a little cryptic, but people who are have read some of their philosophy will figure out pretty quick that we're talking about Plato and the allegory of the cave.
Okay, and so then I asked you, we're talking about Plato, why did you title the episode Socrates?
Well, we'll get to that in a second. Tell me everything you know right now about Plato.
This is going to be bad.
not counting. Well, no, it's okay because I figure that, you've said I've never read Plato. So I figure a lot of our audience hasn't read Plato. Okay. So I want to know, where is the average audience member at?
The common man?
The common man.
All right. Well,
is that what I said last week you called me
the common man?
Gosh, I don't mean to be a Richard.
Okay.
It just comes naturally.
All right. So I know there's something called the Republic.
Yes.
I now know that.
Do you know what the Republic's about?
Is that his main?
It's one of the big
popular
ones. Probably the biggest, but yeah.
Okay. So Plato is a teacher of philosophy.
Yeah.
Sometimes people
philosopher.
Sometimes people call different views by him, Platonic views.
Yeah.
He is a contemporary of Socrates.
He's Socrates' pupil, actually.
Okay. He developed this allegory about a cave. And that is all I know.
Okay. Well, that's okay.
So wait. Who else were they friends with? Our famous philosophers,
Aristotle.
Aristotle. Yep. Yeah. I was going to guess that, but I didn't want to embarrass myself.
No, so, you're fine.
So Aristotle. Okay. Who else?
Aristotle and Socrates. In fact, if you look at the famous painting of the School of Athens, mm-hmm. right in the center, you see Plato and Socrates are the two figures at the center of that painting, and Plato is the one pointing up, because that's the direction his philosophy was focused on, as we'll talk about.
God.
Not so much God, but what's beyond this physical world, okay. whereas Aristotle was more what's here, you know. So Aristotle is pointing down in the painting. So go Google the School of Athens. It's a great painting,
okay.
and take a look at it.
Nice. And what else? So tell me some things I should know right off the top okay. about Plato.
So Plato, this goes back to your original question. Wait a second. I thought it was Plato's allegory of the cave. Why is his title Spelunking with Socrates?
Yeah.
Well, Plato wrote Socratic dialogues. Okay. Now, are you familiar with what a Socratic dialogue is?
So this is – no, I might be wrong. I'm just guessing on these things. I think to make points – he wouldn't just lay out his argument. He would lay out both counter arguments to get to his main point. Is that correct?
That's pretty correct. What a Socratic dialogue is it's basically their stories. So they're fiction, basically. Mm-hmm. Most of Plato's work in these Socratic dialogues takes the form of the character Socrates,
mm-hmm.
who at least to some degree is probably based on the real Socrates and mm-hmm. what he said, but more likely Plato's adaptation of Socrates to his own philosophical views. And so Socrates will be engaged by somebody in an argument, and they will have this philosophical debate, which Socrates inevitably wins
okay.
because he is much better than all these other people.
And you told me something really interesting earlier today, that Socrates doesn't have any writing, or we don't
yeah.
really have any writing that was done by Socrates. So everything that is credited to him was actually presented to us by Plato.
Well, by Plato and some other people.
Okay.
Yeah, so there were other people who wrote Socratic dialogues, but Plato's the big name. So yeah, if you go to your bookstore and say, I want every book written by Socrates, I'm going to study this guy, you're not going to get any.
Okay.
Because he didn't write any.
That's really interesting, because we hear his name and it just is
right.
so common to think he's one of the big names in philosophy. There must be a lot out there by him.
Yeah.
But he's just a character.
Well, he's a real person.
I mean, he's a real person, yeah. but he's just a character in Plato's writings. And then so we attribute these things that he maybe said and maybe didn't.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just things that Plato knows Socrates would be on board with, or maybe it's literally just a character that Plato was playing with.
Right.
I mean, understanding that Socrates was also a real person,
yeah.
he might have just taken this name because he respected the man.
Yeah. How far is the Socrates and Plato removed from the historical Socrates.
Exactly.
And in fact, spoiler alert, Socrates actually dies in the dialogues.
A lot of times?
No. One of the famous dialogues is the Apology of Socrates, which is his defense of himself when he is brought on trial for corrupting the youths of Athens
okay.
with his philosophical teachings. And then so he is condemned to death. And then in another dialogue, his friends break into prison and try and convince him to leave. And Socrates has an argument with them about why it's more moral for him to stay in prison. So his friends are like, come on, Socrates, let's get out of here. Hang on, we're going to talk about this. And then he doesn't leave. So wow. Socrates executed for his teachings.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah, but today the dialogue that's relevant today is the Republic.
Okay.
So it's in Book 7 of the Republic that we get the allegory of the cave.
Now, have you read the Republic?
I am reading the Republic,
and that's why it's fresh in your mind right
yeah,
now.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, how many books are there?
10 books in the Republic,
and you're already through Book 7.
Yeah, just finished Book 7
okay.
this week. So, what the Republic is about is it begins as a dialogue. The initial question on the table is, what is justice? Okay, so they debate this, and, you know, as usually happens in a Socratic dialogue, the person throws out a definition that they're quite confident in, and then Socrates, through questions, explains to them why they're wrong, and which is part of what's brilliant about Socrates, is that he very rarely makes assertions. He almost always asks questions.
Okay.
And that's one of the things, like, when people get mad at him or he's brought on trial, he's like, I'm just asking questions. But there are very leading questions, and mm-hmm. so it's a little bit disingenuous.
And again, this is Socrates, yeah. the character,
right,
not
right.
the man.
So they're having this discussion about justice, and then they get on to what would be the perfectly just state.
And so we get this wild republic that Socrates and his conversation partners dream up as their idea, picturing what would be the ideal state look like. Mm-hmm. And so they start thinking through things like, okay, we want people who are good at being warriors to be warriors and good at artisans to be artisans and to excel at their task. And, you know, in terms of the arts, we want to make sure that heroes are presented as heroic. So we're going to go through and censor everything in Homer that might present Achilles as being unheroic, or he's, you know, there's a scene, great scene at the end of the Iliad where Priam and Achilles are crying together over Priam over the death of Hector and, Achilles over the death of Patroclus, and they're like, nope, that's got to go because it shows them as really weak. So they're censoring this stuff and saying in our state that can't be. And then there's no marriage. The wives and the men just go at it or whoever. And the once the children are born, they're kept in common so that nobody knows who's who, whose children are whose.
Wow.
So that there's no nepotism.
Why is that? Besides nepotism, why else would that be a positive?
Because, well, and it's not, but in the argument of the dialogue, the idea is that to form this perfect state, if somebody is, you know, say a blacksmith, and then he has a son, his son's going to be a blacksmith, but his son might not be ideally suited to being a blacksmith. Mm-hmm. So therefore, now we have a breakdown in justice in the state.
Okay.
Because justice in the Republic is serving the needs of the many, so serving the state. Not the individual. Okay. So if Bob is the son of a blacksmith, but he sucks at being a blacksmith, we don't want him to be a blacksmith because now we have a breakdown in our republic.
Okay.
So we hold all the children in common and nobody knows whose is whose. And that way Bob will be whatever is best suited to him.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Right. And then the state's going to be ruled by philosophers. So we're going, you know, all through this. And then we get to the idea of education and forms of education. And that's where we get the famous allegory of the cave.
All right. Now, I watched something you posted on the Sci-Fi Christian Facebook page today,
yes.
Which was a short 3-minute video that depicts in claymation the allegory of the cave.
Yes.
And so that prepares me now for this conversation, but let's describe it in audio form.
Right.
Go.
Okay. So, Matt, you and I are prisoners. In this alley. I'm going to make it about us.
Okay.
So we are prisoners, and we've always been prisoners our whole life.
Our whole lives, we've been chained up in a cave.
Yes, and we are facing a wall. Okay?
Yes.
So unlike right now where we're facing each other, we're both facing the same way.
So I can look left and right, but I can't look behind me.
You can't look behind you. You can't, you know, basically you can only look one direction. You can look straight ahead.
Straight ahead at the wall of the cave.
At the wall of the cave. And maybe we can see each other. Hey, Matt.
Yeah.
Hey, man. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
I know.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So we could probably still do our podcast or whatever, but we're just looking at the wall of the cave.
But behind us.
Behind us. There is a huge fire that casts light on the cave. So we can see the cave wall very clearly, okay?
Yes.
And in front of the fire, there's all sorts of wild stuff taking place.
Well, there's a bridge.
There's a bridge.
And people and animals and there's things crossing the bridge. And so, because of the fire, it's casting shadows on our cave wall.
Yes. So we see these shadows only, and that's all we have ever seen in our entire lives, okay? So we're seeing the shadows, and then the jailer comes up and says, hey, Ben, you've been doing great.
Ben is right.
You're out of here. Okay. Now, this is where we start to get a little bit beyond the claymation. I think some of this is in there, but not all of it. So I'm released. Now, the first thing that's going to happen to me, according to the allegory of the cave, is I'm going to turn around. I'm going to see all these, you know, these real people.
Yeah.
Finally, for the first time. And my mind's going to be completely blown. I've got no category for how to deal with this.
Because all you've ever known are the men with you in the cave, chained
yes.
up, and the wall and the shadows.
So at first, this is really tough for me because I want to say, no, the shadows are what's real to me. This stuff is just nonsense. It doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I stick with it for a while, and eventually I realize, oh, these guys are casting the shadows on the wall. Okay, now I get it.
Okay.
So I'm okay with that. So then I can start to work my way out of the cave, and I get to experience more and more of the world, you know, and so I start to put the pieces together till eventually I can experience, even look at the sun, which in the allegory represents the source of everything.
Okay.
So my knowledge slowly grows and grows and grows until I'm able to embrace more and more reality and ultimately the highest form of reality.
Which is?
The sun in the allegory.
Okay.
Okay. But then, because I am a benevolent fellow, I think, oh, well, poor Matt down there in the cave. I should go see how he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I head down into the cave. And I'm back home for the first time. And now I'm really confused again because I'm looking at these shadows. And before, this was everything I ever knew. This was all reality. And now they don't make any sense to me. So it's like, well, how could I ever thought those were real?
Mm-hmm.
But meanwhile, I'm sitting next to you and they're like, dude, this is it. You know, these shadows, man, these are what's real. And so I start to tell you all about, oh, there's people behind there and then there's the sun and there's this whole world outside of the cave. And you're just seeing these shadows. You're not seeing the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, according to Socrates, you're going to get really pissed at me. You're going to even want to kill me if you can, because what I'm going to say is so incomprehensible to you.
Yeah.
That it's not going to work. We can't mesh together because I've experienced something that I fundamentally can't explain to you in your state.
I don't have a context for it.
Yes. So that is the allegory of the cave. Now
what is the conclusion of it? Like, how would you summarize? I mean, what you just said just kind of leaves you hanging. Like, I don't understand, and right. We just can't mix because we now are in two different states.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what we're going to talk about.
Okay.
Is what comes next. But first, is the story clear? You know, do you get what the allegory is from a story standpoint?
Well, I get it. I hope the listeners do. Otherwise, yeah. They're going to be lost the rest of the show.
Yeah. So, listeners, if that wasn't clear, go watch the claymation video.
On our Facebook page.
Yeah. And check back. So.
Continuing on.
So there's a lot of things we can take from the allegory of the cave as far as, okay, so this is a nice little story and it's a little creepy and weird, but what exactly does Socrates mean by this? Well, maybe the most famous meaning here is that this is the source of the Platonic theory of forms or Platonic dualism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if we're looking at it through that perspective, this is how we would understand the allegory of the cave. That the world around us that we're looking at, you know, this table and our bodies and all this good stuff, those are like the shadows on the cave. They're not the real thing. True reality exists in what Plato calls the forms.
And okay? That's the humans, animals, all the things that were casting the shadows?
Yes, in the allegory. Those would be representative of the forms.
And the sun?
Yeah, well, the sun would be the ultimate source of the forms.
Okay.
So sun, ultimate being, then the forms, and then physical reality as we experience it.
Okay.
So he uses the example, or one of the more famous examples he used to explain this, is the color blue. Okay, so if you think of some things that are blue, you know, sky, we say, is blue. The oceans are blue. Your shirt is blue that you're wearing right now.
Mm-hmm.
But all of these look very different, right? We say they're blue, but if we put all of them next to each other, they don't look blue. And so what we'd say, according to the theory of forms, Plato's theory of forms, is that each of them reflects the form blue, which exists outside of reality, or our perceived reality anyway. Mm-hmm. The real blue in each of these only reflect it to varying degrees and in varying ways, which is why we can say that all those things are blue, even though they don't look or the same.
Okay. There are different forms of blue.
No, there's one form of blue that different things reflect.
Differently.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
With you.
All right. Now, this may sound a little familiar from our discussion recently about Aristotle.
Yes, from a couple weeks back.
Yes.
Now episode 172.
Yeah. Well, you remember we discussed the four causes, right?
Yeah.
You know, the formal cause, the efficient cause, the material cause, and the final cause. So you can go listen to that episode and get mad at us, because that's what most people do when they listen to that episode.
Okay.
Or just fast forward to that part, and you'll be in good shape.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to hear about Aristotle. So, but the difference here is that, because these sound really familiar, and in some ways they are, but the difference is Plato's theory of forms is more abstract. We're talking about things behind reality.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Aristotle would say that, no, this table, yes, it's a form of tableness, ideal tableness, but that ideal of tableness is seen right here in the physical object.
Okay.
It's not just this physical object isn't a shadow cast by the form. The form is actually, we see the form in this table.
Okay.
So that's oversimplification, but that's kind of where we're going.
Okay.
All right. So here's kind of what I want to do with this. What I was thinking would be fun is that there's some theology we can talk about here. I think that there's some storytelling aspects we can pull out of the allegory of the cave. But where I thought would be interesting to start, and this was the question of the day, which did not get many responses because I think people were confused by what the allegory of the cave was.
Well, it's a good thing you put the video there. Yeah. Otherwise, I would have just skipped it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. But I asked people, what sci-fi movie, book, or TV show would you use to illustrate the allegory of the cave? So I'm going to put you on the spot here.
Yeah, I mean, I know somebody else said The Matrix, and that for some reason, that is one that jumps to mind. But I don't think it's a perfect description, because what you just said is it was impossible for me, the prisoner, to understand what you're trying to say. I think people that were outside The Matrix could explain what The Matrix was. So they had some sort of common ground to speak about. So I don't know. That's the first one that comes to mind. But which one have you thought of?
Yeah, so The Matrix is a good one. And you're right. Depending on how strongly we want to state that part, it may or may not work. But even in The Matrix, you know, Neo hears Morpheus explain this. He believes Morpheus, but he doesn't really get it till he's out in the real world.
Yeah.
So we could argue that it still works, at least in a softer form.
Yeah.
But yeah, The Matrix works really well because the whole idea that the world around you isn't the real thing. It's a reflection of reality. In this case, a reality that doesn't even exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, very much Platonic dualism there.
What about, so when you're talking about this is not the real reality, you know, when Narnia, when C.S. Lewis writes about how this world is like a shadow land or
right.
shadow of what's right. going to be in eternity. Do you think that ties together?
Yeah. Yeah, that could. I mean, that's where we're going to get to as far as how far do we want to push this theologically?
Because mm-hmm.
that's going to be the real question when it comes to this and evaluating the Platonic theory of forms when it comes to Christianity and Christian theology.
Yeah.
So you're definitely on the right track. But yeah, what C.S. Lewis is talking about, that could be very much seen as reflecting that.
Which ones did you come up with?
I wrote down, Paul wrote one about The Hobbit, which I'm going to get to in a minute.
Okay.
I don't want to get to that one yet because it's really good. I want to save it for a bit later in the conversation. But Dark City, which is...
haven't seen it.
Is similar to The Matrix in some ways.
Okay.
Pretty much everything Philip K. Dick has ever written.
Okay.
You know, because he's always playing with reality and, you know, what's real and what's
Adjustment
not.
Bureau shows
right,
that.
Yeah. Right. So that type of thing. Inception.
Oh.
Inception's actually a really good one if you think about it.
Okay.
Because you kind of have these different levels of reality, which are similar to what the allegory of the cave describes, where it's not just shadows and then the real world. It's that, okay, we back away from the shadows and then we're closer, but we're not there yet. And so Inception presenting these ideas of realities that are, you know, 2-3 more steps removed from the real world,
okay.
To the point where we don't even know if we're actually in the real world at any point in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, so, but there is this ideal out there that says the real world exists, but we're not sure if we can get there. So that to me is a really good illustration.
That's a good one, yeah.
Of the cave. So anything like that that's really going to play around with reality. But The Hobbit, I want to read what Paul said here because this is fascinating to
Who
me.
Who did The Matrix? So let's give them a shout out.
Mickey and Scott.
Okay.
So good job, guys. The Matrix is probably if you're just going to sit down with somebody and say, I'm going to show you one movie that explains it, you'd probably choose The Matrix.
Okay.
And just go with that.
Paul Lewis wrote about
Paul Lewis. He says, how about The Hobbit? Bilbo and most of the other hobbits are isolated by choice and cultural pressure from the fantastic world of Middle-earth. It takes a wizard from that world to break into Bilbo's isolation to show him a reality that he could not have previously understood. Bilbo comes back to Hobbiton and tells his stories to the other hobbits, but most of the things he is telling them aren't comprehended. So very, very similar there, that there's a world out there, but you don't get it till you step into this. So I liked what Paul got there.
That was good.
That wouldn't
outside
be an obvious
the box.
One.
Yeah.
I mean, you could even, now when you start thinking that way, a whole bunch more open up. Like you could Star Wars.
Yeah. Anytime the hero's journey happens.
Right. It could be a form of this. Because it really is that sense of perceived reality and then breaking into a larger world. The reason The Matrix works maybe a little bit better in terms of getting the full push of the analogy is because it has that sense of it's not just I haven't, you know, gone outside Mounds View, Minnesota or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's that the entire world is a false reality. And that's more what the theory of forms is getting at.
Yeah. That's, okay. I'm with you on this one.
So I'm going to give you a choice, sir.
Okay.
Do you want to talk theology or storytelling first?
Ooh, well, I'm always prone to jump to theology, but for the sake of the show, let's make theology the grand finale.
Okay.
Is that how will it work better for your notes?
Yeah, no, that's fine. They're
interchangeable?
Yeah, they're interchangeable. And theology is going to work well because, as we talked about earlier, we're going to set up some things for an episode that we will get to
when
we
get back.
So we will be taking some of the things we're going to talk about in brief today and expanding on them more when we return.
Nice.
Much like Jesus.
Well, we're not going to return exactly like Jesus.
Well, pretty close.
It's not going to...
Behold, we are coming back soon.
Oh, we should... Okay, write that down so we can put that on the Facebook page. I'm gonna type it out right now.
And lo, we are with you always twice a week with these pre-recorded episodes until the end of August.
Okay, I'm writing this down. Okay, you read. I'm going to write that down.
Okay. So there's this whole... What we've been talking about so far is understanding the allegory of the cave through the lens of this Platonic theory of form. So we're using it to make sense of reality or offer a possible explanation of reality. Now, from a Christian standpoint, there's maybe some problems with that we're going to get to in the theology section. But before we get to that, what I want to suggest is that that's not the only application of the theory of the allegory of the cave. That the allegory of the cave could actually really work well for a number of other things, including one of our favorite topics, which is why do stories matter?
Yes.
Okay, so let's play around with this.
Okay.
If we try and, you know, plug in the topic of stories into the allegory of the cave, what we find is pretty fascinating. So let's think of stories for a second, I want to offer a disclaimer that this might sound negative towards stories as though we're talking about them as something that is less good or something to grow out of, but that's not what we're trying to say, and that'll become clear. But let's think of stories as a form of shadows, okay?
Okay.
So quite literally, you know, we're in the movie theater now, and we're quite literally seeing something reflected on the screen in front of us as we watch that.
Okay.
What is the purpose of that? How do we think about that? One of the things we've argued a lot, Matt, is that it's a mistake to just think of stories as pure entertainment, that stories are intended for something more.
Yeah, like in the old form of telling stories, there was a moral to the story. So you were listening to the oral traditions or reading these books or short stories to have some impact on your life.
Yeah. Maybe a perfect example would be the parables in the Bible.
Yes.
Okay, so Jesus tells the parable of the prodigal son. That is, he's throwing some shadows up on the wall for his listeners. Now, behind those shadows, though, is what he's trying to get at. It's the message, you know, the Good Samaritan, care for one another, love one another, all that. Okay. But then you can back it up even farther, because if we just stop there, we haven't got to what we really want to get to, which is the source of everything. We ultimately, the parables are meant to point us to God, ultimately. And so we have these different levels, just like in the allegory of the cave. We have the shadows, which is the story itself. We have the meaning behind the shadows. And then we have what the meaning is ultimately supposed to lead us to. So I find that to be a very fascinating way to look at stories. Now, that's nice for Jesus, but the question is, does that actually work for stories that we enjoy?
And so you're asking me?
Yes.
Because you stopped talking. Okay. I didn't know if this was actually, if it was rhetorical.
Oh,
or,
sorry.
No, so this is for me. I don't think it always works in real life.
Okay.
Because Jesus was telling stories in a way where he was trying to get them to recognize some sort of truth. But I think today people aren't always telling stories in a way that they want us to see some new truth or get to some understanding. They're just telling stories for the sake of storytelling, entertainment value.
Right. So we have a sense almost where the shadows are the beginning and the end in the allegory.
In some allegories.
In some. Well, yeah. If we take those cases of pure entertainment. Now, I would say that that's maybe a little oversimplistic, just because I think that the reason something is entertaining is because it triggers something inside of us.
Mm-hmm.
But it might be at a very visceral, mm-hmm. immature level. But there's always something casting the shadow. But I think the basic point is right, that a lot of stories exist simply to throw the shadows up on the screen and then leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's I think that's a really fascinating way of making one of our central points on the show, because what we've always said is that stories are meant to show something beyond that. And so if all we're doing is stopping at the shadows, we're missing the entire rest of the world,
mm-hmm.
which is that stories are meant to show us what's out there. Mm-hmm. You know, so for example, we've talked about how, you know, you with the basic stuff, you have teaching a moral. Okay, well, that's an easy one. We have a moral, we use the moral to drive a story, and on it goes. But, you know, you can also have cultural exploration casting a shadow. You can have historical exploration casting a shadow. You can have socioeconomic themes or sociopolitical themes casting a shadow. You can have emotional things casting a shadow. So we think of something like Nolan's Dark Knight trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
So Dark Knight, obviously big themes of heroism in there, themes of power. You know, what's appropriate power for the state or for individuals trying mm-hmm. to do good? Well, that's a very relevant theme in the real world. And so in fact, a lot of people picked up on that and said, well, Nolan's just trying to get into the war on terror mindset. Whether that was intentional or not, you can see how this actually worked quite brilliantly, that people see the shadow on the screen, they sit down and watch the movie, they see what's casting the shadow, which is this theme of terrorism, mm-hmm. What is and is not too far, heroism, all this stuff, how much power is too much power, and so that's kind of the people walking on the bridge, and then they're able to take that and see the real world application behind it. Okay.
Okay, yeah.
So that is a fascinating way of looking at stories, when we come right down to it. And it also gets to why stories aren't just something that is fun to do, but something that we actually need as humans. Because you remember the part of the allegory where the guy is freed and he doesn't get it yet, right?
Yeah.
Well, so in a sense, there's kind of this looking back and forth. I'm looking at these things casting the shadows. I don't understand them. But in order to understand them, I actually need to look back at the shadows, compare the two till I get
a realization.
Exactly. And because we're never going to be fully acclimated, at least not in this life,
mm-hmm.
there's this constant need for stories for us.
So the stories are speaking something deeper to our souls?
Exactly. Exactly.
About God.
Whether it's about God, about our world, about anything. I mean, ultimately God, because if we're to follow the allegory strictly, it would all lead back to God. But even, you know, something like Game of Thrones, okay, there's a lot of fascinating things to say in there about gender, about politics, about class struggles and socioeconomic situations. In fact, as somebody who's read the books, one of the things you notice in the books is that almost all the point of view characters George R. R. Martin chooses outside of Ned Stark are women or people who have some type of disability, like Tyrion, or somebody who is not in a powerful position.
Or children.
And that's a very powerful statement that he's making. That's an intentional choice, and that's a thematic choice because he's trying to show us this type of world that we're familiar with through eyes we don't normally look at it through. Mm-hmm. So does that lead directly to God? No, we could say ultimately it does, because maybe it increases our understanding of the world, which would lead us to God. So maybe ultimately it does. But in the short term, it's helping us better understand history and socioeconomic conditions and gender issues and all of that stuff.
Okay. All right, good.
So we have this need of stories, where stories constantly help us understand our world in a way that we wouldn't otherwise. And that's why, you know, as we'll get into in a minute with like somebody like N.T. Wright, where he's going to really stress seeing the Bible, not just in terms of parables, but seeing the Bible as a whole as a narrative, is a very powerful experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that, why does God present his word to us in narrative form? Well, it's for the sake of story, right?
Mm-hmm. And there is a story that you can follow throughout Old Testament into New Testament into the end.
Yes. Or, you know, think about like my Catholic tradition where we're presented almost every day where it's a saint's feast day or whatever. And you sit down and you read your devotional or whatever, and it's going to tell you about the life of the saint.
Every day is a different saint's day.
Oh, there's so many saints.
Who's today?
Saint Ignatius of Loyola, who is the founder of the Jesuits.
Nice.
Yeah. So how about that?
How about that?
So, you know, you sit down and you read the life of the saint, which is presented to us in narrative form. That's if we just stop there and say, oh, he had an interesting life, it's ultimately worthless. The reason it's devotional is because we're supposed to learn about this hero of the faith, which helps us to understand ourselves and our world better and what we're supposed to be doing, which ultimately points us to God.
Don't tell me the answer, but do you currently have a favorite saint so far?
Yeah.
But no, was this somebody that you knew before you became Catholic? Yes, yeah, Augustine.
Yeah, you okay. Got it.
Yeah, that's not fair. You already knew him.
Augustine.
You already liked him.
Yeah.
Do you have a different saint that you'd never heard of before that you've grown attached to?
Yeah. You take a stab. I don't think you've heard of him.
Give me a hint. What does it start with?
F.
Francis.
Yes, but not that Francis.
Okay, which one?
Francis de Sales.
And what did he do?
He was a Catholic apologist shortly after the Reformation broke out.
But what's he saint of?
I'm not sure what he's the patron of, but...
What? You can't have a favorite if you don't know what they're the saint of.
Look it up.
So
he wrote this great book called The Catholic Controversy, which was a series of pamphlets that he wrote, and he converted a lot of Protestants back to...
A saint that... I have a friend who used to tell me about her favorite saint, which was Saint Anthony.
Yeah.
And because he's the saint of lost things.
Yes.
And now, guess what? I'm living in the city, Saint Anthony Village, Minnesota.
Yes!
Well, okay, what did you...
I was just cheering you on.
Oh, wow.
But I... This is kind of interesting.
Okay.
Well, you continue your story.
No, the end.
He is the patron of Baker, Oregon, Cincinnati, Ohio.
What?
Catholic Press, Columbus, Ohio, confessors, deaf people, educators, Uppington, South Africa, Wilmington, Delaware, writers, journalists, the Institute of Christ the King, Sovereign Priest. So... This is kind of what happens with us Catholics, is there's more things to be patrons of than there are saints.
Yeah, so you just give them a bunch.
Like, there's some guy who existed in, like, 700s or whatever, who's the patron saint of the internet. I just like to picture how that conversation went down in heaven. Oh, I got a new assignment
good
for
news.
You.
Good news. There's this hot new thing. It's called the internet. And you're in charge.
What? It's like you think your grandma's bad at the internet, just... Picture this guy.
Okay, hey, you want to hear a funny story from work today?
Yeah.
Okay, I won't be specific, but I work at a university, and so we've been having some browser compatibility issues today, or in the last week. And so in order to do this task that students have to do for a registration process, it turns out Internet Explorer isn't working. So I've been getting tons of calls.
Yeah.
And so I had this older mother on the phone today, and she starts describing the problem, and right away I'm like, okay, I know what you have to do. Internet Explorer, for some reason, we're having some browser compatibility issues. So if you just switch over to Google Chrome or to Firefox, it should be okay. And I said, do you have those things? She's like, yeah, I use Google all the time.
No one should use Internet Explorer. If you're using Internet Explorer, you're doing the internet wrong.
And so I had to explain to her that Google, everybody has Google. Okay, check. But there's something there's something called a browser named Google Chrome. Are you familiar with that? And she said she was, but she called me back 5 minutes later.
She was not.
She was not. So
yikes.
Okay. Well, let's move on.
Yeah, go find a young friend and have him help you.
Ask what a browser is.
Yeah. So see, you guys should have prayed to the patron saint of the internet. Your
which
problems
been which it was?
I don't know his name.
And so again, your guy's name is Francis of the
Francis de Sales.
Francis de Sales.
Yeah.
D. Silas.
Salas. It's spelled sales, but I don't think it's pronounced that way because it's French. So.
All right. Sorry about that. Let's get back on track.
It was like a good halftime show and everything. Okay. So that's stories. And I just want to make it clear that like in the Allegory of the Cave, the shadows are presented as some kind of something that you want to get away from.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're not saying stories are like, oh, bad, you know, and you're supposed to outgrow them. I think the point is that we're never going to be fully acclimated. So there's always this need for stories and God gave them to us. So
nice theology.
Ghost stories. So yeah, let's hit a little theology. So let's come back to this idea of Platonic dualism. So this world is not the real world.
Okay.
This is a pretty popular idea in a lot of Christian theology. The whole idea that we have...
I hate this.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, sorry. This is just one of those issues I feel strongly about.
So do I. So do I.
Okay.
So we have the sense of... We live here on Earth,
mm-hmm.
and that's not our home, right?
Right.
Because we're citizens of heaven.
Not of this world.
We're not of this world. So we take some verses like that, and then, oh, Paul's always talked about flesh is bad, spirit's mm-hmm. good. We got to do that. And when we die, we're going to go to heaven, and that's this other reality, which we would look at, you know, as kind of being analogous to the reality of the forms or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that's the goal. We're in this bad world. That's not real, and we got to get to the real world, which is heaven.
Yeah.
Okay. Why is this worldview so popular among Christians? And B, is it accurate?
Okay, first let's hit B. It's not accurate.
It's not.
Okay, so people often, like Ben was saying, think of heaven as being someplace far off, but what they fail to recognize is that the Bible is pretty clear that this earth that we're currently living on is going to be renewed, and that the new heavens and new earth, when they talk about that, that is here. So this world that we're currently living in is also the world that we live in forever. So it's not that we're going off someplace. It's that heaven and earth are going to come together, and here it is. So just like we don't believe that our bodies are pointless, that someday the body will be resurrected and renewed, and we'll be living in this body forever.
Yeah.
Earth, same way. And
exactly.
So, okay, so...
Now, we're going to do a whole episode on that.
Yeah, so that's what's coming up in the fall. Because I've been wanting to talk about this a lot because I work in a Christian workplace, Christian university, like I said. And I have coworkers who were recently talking to me about how they'd never heard this view. They've always thought of heaven as almost an alternate reality that you go to, this heavenly realm.
Yeah.
And I don't know what they think is going to happen to Earth. Maybe, probably just destroyed.
Yeah.
And so... Yeah, we definitely want to tackle that.
Yeah,
and
so we're going to get into some N.T. Wright stuff, his Surprised by Hope.
Surprised by Hope, which both of you and I have read, but you've actually finished.
Yes.
And I have read some of. And so, okay, why do I think it is popular? I think, one thing that comes to mind is just the way that heaven is depicted in cartoons and TV and movies and just like the media, the general... depiction that we're given as young children is this cloudy, far-off place. And so I think that it does start to get ingrained in our minds at a young age, and we don't even think about it. And I also don't think that there's good teaching on what the Bible says about the afterlife.
Right.
Unless you're at a funeral, you barely even hear about the afterlife.
Right. Yeah, and a part of it is actually, too, the whole rapture culture.
Yes.
Which...
Oh, we did an episode on this.
Yeah, and you and I have both studied the... history of evangelicalism
mm-hmm.
in our history of Christianity classes at Northwestern. And so one of the things we learned about is that the rapture really doesn't exist.
Within the last 200 years.
Yeah, until mid-19th century. And in fact, a lot of it has to do with theological optimism taking a back seat after the Civil War. So the sense of we're going to build heaven on earth and we're going to create mm-hmm. the perfect society collapses a lot in the Civil War. Into a more pessimistic view, and so we start to get this view of that the world is something we need to escape from because it's never going to be okay. It's always going to be bad.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get somebody like D.L. Moody, who's the famous evangelist, who has the famous line of, God said to me, Moody, you've got a lifeboat, and you just save as many people as you can. So the sense that, you know, the world is drowning, and the goal is just to get people into the boat so that they can not get left behind, and,
mm-hmm.
you know...
Yeah, I'm just thinking.
Go to heaven with Tim LaHaye and all that great stuff.
I was just thinking, we're going to time loop this month while we're away. Actually, I should say August. We're going to time loop the first appearance of Kobe on the Sci-Fi Christian episode 12. But right before we do the episode on the afterlife. We should time loop our one where we made fun of Left Behind.
Yes.
And talked about that. So watch for that coming in September.
So that's kind of the tease for a future episode. And I think that you really can't understand that topic unless you understand the influence of Platonic philosophy on Christian theology.
Mm-hmm.
And what we'll get into more is the whole idea that, well, the Bible isn't being written with Platonic philosophy in mind. It's being written with a more Jewish mindset that type of duality is just foreign to. But for us, you know, as we look back on the Bible with both those mindsets, it gets really confusing. So
good.
We'll come to that. But the other theological category I wanted to hit a little bit was I'm fascinated by this aspect in the allegory of the cave where the guy comes back,
mm-hmm.
and he tries to
evangelize.
He tries to evangelize,
mm-hmm.
and say, this is what's out there. And they not only don't get it, but according to the allegory of the cave, they can't get it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really fascinating to me because one of the topics that I'm interested in theologically are what parts of faith can only be understood from an insider perspective.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I think about that a lot, but go ahead.
Give you a perfect example that there are things about Catholicism, for example, that didn't make sense to me until I became a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
Like until I made that decision that I want to be a Catholic. And then there were things that clicked because my worldview fundamentally shifted. Now, obviously, there was enough to get me in the door. But there's things that just didn't make sense mm-hmm. from an outsider perspective, and then they did. You know, maybe one of the best examples is the whole sola scriptura debate, that once you accept Catholicism, that worldview of sola scriptura doesn't make sense to me anymore. But when I'm a Protestant, that's such a central deal that it makes it's something that not only makes a lot of sense, but that you depend on a lot.
Yes, just to be clear, scripture alone.
Yeah, so that sense of... That's an issue that if you're a Protestant, I think you can really only understand it from the inside in some ways. And if you're a Catholic, the mix of scripture and tradition in the same way can only be understood fully from the inside. And so there's issues like that. But leaving aside, you know, the Catholic-Protestant thing, just think about Christianity as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the things that we accept as Christians that we just nod our heads at, that this guy 2,000 years ago died and came back from the dead. And that's very much an insider position.
Yeah, that's why I think it's really hard to convince somebody to become a Christian. I know we can't convince them, but just for the sake of conversation, you can't really talk somebody into accepting Christianity just based on the Bible, because to them, the Bible isn't authoritative the way it is to us.
Right.
And so, yeah, you do have to have a change of mindset. I also wonder, and this might have to do more with what the Spirit does inside of us, but even when we can't really hold non-Christians to the same standard that we hold each other.
Yeah.
Like we can't expect non-Christians to live a Christian life. And so, like, you know, just following certain moral guidelines that you and I and other Christian brothers and sisters would follow, it's not fair for us to hold non-Christians to that because they don't believe the same thing as us. And because of that, they don't have the Spirit to empower them to live out that Christian life. And so do you think that that is just a Spirit-based thing, or do you think that also goes in line with what you're talking about?
Oh, I think it totally does. I think it totally does. And that's part of the issue is that there's almost this paradox of that we're called to evangelize, you know, the Great Commission. And for example, right now in Catholicism, there's this whole push for what's called the new evangelization, to get out there and to really push the to evangelize the church and the church's message and the church's mission and all that. And I think you listen to conversion stories, and a lot of those things do play a factor. But yet there's also this other side of that whatever worldview you're talking about, unless you're an insider in it, there's a sense where you're just looking at shadows.
Mm-hmm.
So there, it's this really difficult task that's out there in terms of the mixture of evangelism, but then also recognizing that nothing you say ultimately can prove what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's a fascinating problem to me.
Another thing that came to mind, I don't know if you're going to bring this up, but when the prisoner who was released is trying to talk to his friend who's still...
Yeah,
you know, still trapped in the cave, and the person in the cave can't understand it. Something that came to mind was how God in the Bible is depicted as sometimes opening up people's eyes and sometimes
right.
not allowing them to see, or not, they're not, some people aren't called
yeah.
in the same way that others are. Does that idea speak at all to your notes here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that could certainly play into it in the sense that obviously what we're getting at is that there has to be some level of God opening someone's eyes. And this gets to the whole free will predestination thing we're talking about mm-hmm. before, because obviously somebody from a Calvinistic position is going to say, well, yeah, God only opened certain people's eyes. Mm-hmm. Whereas people more on the free will side would say, well, God opens everyone's eyes, at least to varying degrees, and only certain people choose to take that step to actually understand reality versus the shadow. So I think it would play in there very well. And for those of us who are in the both crowd, there's some mixture in there mm-hmm. that we don't fully understand.
Yeah, and we're okay with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think this also, maybe to take it in a more philosophical direction, this also pokes some significant holes if you subscribe to this interpretation of the allegory of the cave. In empiricism, in rationalism, in the sense of maybe even of democracy as a system, where the ideal of democracy is we all sit down, we hash it out together, and then we're able to come to a consensus that's for the good of all or whatever. Well, does that really work if this is reflective of reality? If I can't truly understand what it's like to be an insider of X political philosophy, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it is, then I'm just going to butt heads with those people
mm-hmm.
Because they're not going to understand me because they're not insiders to me. And I'm not insiders to them. So it's almost like we're both throwing shadows up for each other and we can't yeah. really get it done. So I think it certainly casts some doubt on how effective a democratic system can actually be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's also the great Winston Churchill quote where he says that democracy is the worst system ever except for all the others that haven't tried, so maybe you fall back on that. But I think that's something that's worth thinking about, especially as, you know, we tend to look at democracy as the great hope of the world that needs to be spread to everyone everywhere, of rationalism as the great triumph of mankind, and we've left behind the dark ages of medieval superstition and all that. Well, there's certainly good things that have come out of democracy, and there's certainly good things that have come out of modernism, but it's not as simple as that. You know, we've lost some of the appreciation, I think, for what Plato's talking about.
Hmm. Okay. How would you apply this to today's current political atmosphere?
Well, I think you have a lot of people who are doing exactly what we just talked about, throwing up shadows for each other. Yeah. And
that's why
they don't understand.
That's why positive changes can't be made, because they're both stating their opinions, but they're not sharing the same context.
Right. Because I think the fundamental flaw or the fundamental obstacle in the allegory of the cave is a failure to realize that you're looking at shadows. And to realize, and that takes a lot of discipline when you're talking to somebody you don't agree with mm-hmm. to realize that how you see their perspective is ultimately a shadow of how they experience it internally. And that's a very difficult thing to come to, whether mm-hmm. it's politics, religion, or anything else. That takes a lot of discipline, and I don't think that we have a cultural atmosphere that conditions us to be disciplined in that way. Mm-hmm. And I don't think postmodern relativism really helps, because the idea that, well, my perspective is valid and so is yours, and everybody has this equally valid perspective, well, then what's the point of actually taking the discipline to learn to really examine perspectives, because we're just getting another point of view that's ultimately relative and meaningless. So I think it takes an appreciation of some amount of objectivity to really dive into this. You did your paper in our Prolegomena class on N.T. Wright's epistemology, right?
Yeah, I think I did it on New Testament and the people.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So in that book, he talks about how he proposes a critical realistic view mm-hmm. Of knowledge, of epistemology, where I understand that my perspective is severely limited the way that is similar to what a postmodernist would say, that our perspectives are really skewed because of my own biases and experiences, mm-hmm. and blah, 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 blah. But I also believe in objective truth, and the way we discover that is through the exchange of stories, through looking at each other's perspectives. And so a big part of that is the discipline then of being able to enter into somebody's worldview and understand that what you're seeing from their perspective is shadows. So another great piece of NT Wright that I'd recommend.
You know, I can see how if people get their heads wrapped around what we're talking about here tonight, it could bring a lot more peace to places where there's currently argument. Because if you're understanding that we're disagreeing, but it's because we're throwing up opposite shadows, or we're not understanding where the other person's really coming from. If you try to take a second, even if you can't get to the same places of understanding as them, if you just take a second to realize we're coming at this from totally different directions and I might not be able to understand that person, I should just back down a little bit because we can't really debate this in a normal fashion because you're in two different places.
Yeah, and I think once you kind of take that step back and really both try and understand each other, that's when real progress gets made, because I think it would be the error you could make with this to say, well, since it's all shadows from my perspective, your perspective, we're never going to get anywhere, so what's the point? Mm. I think that what I would want to say is that, no, you can get somewhere. That's what N.T. Wright's trying to say with his critical realism, is that we can arrive at truth, but it takes an understanding of what our situation actually is.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that you're locked into your perspective, I'm locked into my perspective, and the fact that that's the case makes it all the more important that we actually make progress on those. But we're not going to make progress till we both have an appreciation of that as our situation.
Yeah, I like it.
So I think that brings me to the end of my notes on the cave. We'll obviously get back to some of that. Did you have any other closing thoughts on this before we get to story time?
Wait, yeah, you know, I have the notes that you told me that we were going to talk about, and I just realized I was actually waiting for you to question me in questioning form, these two questions, but we've just covered them.
Exactly.
So, no, I'm ready for story time, but good thoughts there.
Thank you.
You shocked me a little bit with the ending there.
I'm a little shocker.
Okay, go ahead.
So, it's sci-fi Christian story time?
Yeah, do you need me that theme music, or do you have it?
I don't have it.
Oh, well, this is going weird. Here we go.
It's sci-fi Christian story time.
Today's story is about a man named Matt Anderson.
Oh, no. What? What is this going to be?
This is what I promised. I promised I was going to definitively prove. I don't know who put up that question of the day about is Matt the biggest Lost fan ever. I think that was Daniel.
Well.
But whoever put it up.
Yeah.
We had the question of the day earlier on the website earlier this week. Is Matt the biggest Lost fan in the world?
Yes.
And I said, Matt was the biggest Lost fan in the world, but he isn't any longer.
Well, before you jump ahead, as we were kind of debating this, somebody, I can't remember who it was, but somebody suggested that perhaps Wayne Henderson from MediaVoiceOvers.com was the biggest Lost fan because he had a Lost podcast called Lost Casting with Wayne and Dan. And then I reminded the folks, wait a second, I had the Lost Report with Matt Anderson, a YouTube show. So all of a sudden, Wayne got involved, and it sounds like for the, what anniversary is this? 9-year anniversary of Lost coming up here in September. Again, lots of things happening in September.
Might have to move some of those September things to October.
We're going
to
have Wayne versus Dan, the ultimate.
No, Wayne versus Matt.
Not Matt, yeah. Wayne versus Matt. So, again, just to be clear, Wayne Henderson will come on the show, face me in the ultimate Lost trivia challenge.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of you out there are thinking, well, of course, Matt's going to win.
I don't know. I'm going to find the hardest questions I can. And
I'm going to study up.
And you guys are both going to be able to present your credentials and, you know.
But I think I might know where you're going with this story time. But go ahead and tell your story and then I'll.
I don't think you do.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so I said I was going to offer definitive proof that Matt is no longer the biggest Lost fan.
Okay.
Or at least not as big as you were.
Yeah. What is it?
So, Matt, you are somebody who cares a great deal about Lost.
Yeah, I care a great deal about
Lost. And you have collected a great many Lost things, have you not?
Yes.
I want to take you back to your moving day when a conspiracy was hatched.
Oh, no.
Between me and Kobe.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Kobe and I were moving in one of your boxes that contained an item of lost memorabilia.
Interesting.
And Kobe said to me, let's hide this.
Hide the box.
And no, no, not the whole box. Just one item from the box. Let's take it and hide it. We'll see if Matt misses it.
Okay.
And here we are over a month later, and you have not missed it.
Do you have it with you today?
I have it here in this bag. Now, if you are still the biggest Lost fan who cares so much about your Lost memorabilia, you're going to be able to tell me what is in this bag.
I know what's in this bag.
Okay.
It is Lost Season 5.
Incorrect.
The Dharma box.
Next guess.
I don't know where that is then.
St. Anthony.
Okay.
I'll give you three guesses. So that's one.
I don't even know what kind of lost things I'm missing.
See, this is my proof.
Okay, go ahead. I give up.
No other guesses.
No, because I know all my DVDs are over there.
It's not a DVD.
A lost related memory. I know I have. It couldn't be a puzzle.
Is that your second guess?
My second guess is a lost puzzle. All right. Well, then a lost themed. I mean, as big of a fan as I am, I don't have a lot of
and
lost.
This is my point. Is that here we are a month later and you haven't even missed it.
What is it?
It is.
Oh, lost the game.
The game. Oh, pieces are falling out.
Yeah.
This is not good.
No, I didn't realize that was missing.
So I present to you
the
final item of your move.
Oh, my gosh.
Lost the game. And I'll check my... There's a few items that fell out in my backpack.
Yeah,
so they
spilled everywhere.
Later.
Thank you for that. what I thought you were going to say is while we were watching The Wolverine, there was an actor in The Wolverine who was on Lost.
No, you told me about that over dinner.
Yeah, I know. And so, no, we're sitting next to each other at the theater, and I couldn't remember what the character's name was in Lost, and it was bothering me so much because I pride myself in my Lost trivia ability. And this is a character who appeared prominently in multiple episodes, and I could not remember his name.
Now, I would submit that 2 years ago, you would have not only known that character's name, but a month after moving, you would have known that Lost, the board game, was missing and probably been quite concerned about it.
So what do you think is happening to me?
I think you're no longer the biggest Lost fan. You've made room in your heart for Dez.
Oh, my gosh. This is amazing.
This is a great story. Perfect send-off.
It's like I'm having character development over the course of Sci-Fi Christian.
I'm sorry for stealing your item.
No, it's
fine. It was Kobe's idea, so blame him if you're mad.
No, I'm not mad at all. I haven't missed it at all.
You haven't missed it at all.
I didn't even know it was gone.
In fact, that's why, like... The week or two after you moved, we were recording, and I said, so, you missing anything?
Because
we were talking about St. Anthony. No, nothing.
Do you know who got me this game?
I don't.
Sci-Fi Christian own Daniel Butcher.
Oh, very
nice. So, Daniel, thank you for the game. I'll be happy to play it. I just happened to not notice it was gone, but yeah.
Yeah, so... That's Sci-Fi Christian story time.
All right. Well, so let's talk about everything that's going to happen in September. We're going to unveil our brand new Sci-Fi Christian store where you can get Sci-Fi Christian t-shirts, Sci-Fi Christian mugs, Sci-Fi Christian buttons. We're also going to have the episode about heaven and how it's here on Earth. We're going to have the episode about Lost. We're going to have the return of the Sci-Fi Christian because, as a reminder, what you're about to experience will be all pre-recorded episodes over the course of August, including... our top 50 sci-fi TV show countdown that we've been painstakingly recording over the last month. So
now, people have been asking, we've been trying to respond, people have been saying we want some deeper episodes of theology. Yeah. So we've been trying to respond these last 2 weeks.
Yeah, lack of superhero. We're trying to underplay superhero talk.
The countdown, you're not going to get another Ark of the Covenant or Plato or whatever because we're going to be doing the countdown. But that's just because it's pre-recorded and we're going to get back and have some good theology stuff. So... Just everybody knows we're all going to be calm.
Hold your horses.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll take deep breaths, and we'll all be okay somehow. But yeah, big month coming up. We'll have to schedule that right. Maybe we can record right on September 22nd.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
that was never a question.
No, I thought that was what was going to happen.
Okay.
So, all right, Ben. Well, I'll see you, man.
Oh my gosh.
I'll see you in a month. I'll see you on Saturday, probably.
Yeah.
Because
we'll see each other like 3 more times before we leave.
I'm having some trouble editing the video that's going to be played at the rehearsal of my wedding. So I'm going to have to go to Ben's house because my computer is malfunctioning. So, yeah. Ben, I'm going to see you Saturday. I'll see you next Thursday at the rehearsal dinner. I'll see you on a week from Friday when you stand up there as one of my groomsmen.
And maybe we'll see Elysium that morning.
Maybe we'll go see a movie in the morning of my wedding. Who knows?
Yeah, that'd be great.
That's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
Yeah, I'm Ben DiBono.
Signing off.
All right, let me get you these pieces.
Okay, thanks. That's funny. So who was the mastermind? You or Kobe?
Kobe. And I hadn't originally planned on presenting on the show because I thought you were going to miss it a lot sooner. And then we would all have a good laugh about it. But then after you didn't miss it, and it became obvious you weren't going to miss it, it was like, oh my gosh, how am I going to get this back to him without it being really awkward?
Well, this made sense because yes. Now we can announce the law show.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't want to be like 6 months from now, here's this thing I stole from you.
I posted the question, is there a bigger lesson on the map? Because what I was trying to do is...
No, because you didn't capitalize lost with all four letters, and you always do that.
I know, because I actually linked to lost, the Facebook page. And so the reason I did it is because I was trying to see if I could find somebody to call in about lost for our top 100 call-in show. And so, that's kind of the reason. I was trying to see who is a bigger fan.
Yeah.
And so... I guess the listeners can find out during the top 100 where Lost ranked.
Yeah.
All right. So long, folks.